Chapter 26. Nephew, and a small dark gentleman with lively eyes whom she introduced as his tutor, pronouncing a French name as she did so. Into this dimly lit and dim-featured group May Archer floated like a swan with the sunset on her. She seemed larger, fairer, more voluminously rustling than her husband had ever seen her, and he perceived that the rosiness and rustlingness were the tokens of an extreme and infantile shyness. What on earth will they expect me to talk about? Her helpless eyes implored him, at the very moment that her dazzling apparition was calling forth the same anxiety in their own bosoms. But beauty, even when distrustful of itself, awakens confidence in the manly heart, and the vicar and the French name tutor were soon manifesting to May their desire to put her at her ease. In spite of their best efforts, however, the dinner was a languishing affair. Archer noticed that his wife's way of showing herself at her ease with foreigners was to become more uncompromisingly local in her references, so that, though her loveliness was an encouragement to admiration, her conversation was a chill to repartee. The vicar soon abandoned the struggle, but the tutor, who spoke the most fluent and accomplished English, gallantly continued to pour it out to her until the ladies, to the manifest relief of all concerned, went up to the drawing room. The vicar, after a glass of port, was obliged to hurry away to a meeting, and the shy nephew, who appeared to be an invalid, was packed off to bed. But Archer and the tutor continued to sit over their wine, and suddenly Archer found himself talking as he had not done since his last symposium with Ned Winsett. The Carfrey nephew, it turned out, had been threatened with consumption, and had had to leave Harrow for Switzerland, where he had spent 2 years in the milder air of Lake Leman. Being a bookish youth, he had been entrusted to M. Riviere, who had brought him back to England, and was to remain with him till he went up to Oxford the following spring, and M. Riviere added with simplicity that he should then have to look out for another job. It seemed impossible, Archer thought, that he should be long without one, so varied were his interests, and so many his gifts. He was a man of about 30, with a thin ugly face. May would certainly have called him common-looking, to which the play of his ideas gave an intense expressiveness, but there was nothing frivolous or cheap in his animation. His father, who had died young, had filled a small diplomatic post, and it had been intended that the son should follow the same career, but an insatiable taste for letters had thrown the young man into journalism, then into authorship, apparently unsuccessful, and at length, after other experiments and vicissitudes which he spared his listener, into tutoring English youths in Switzerland. Before that, however, he had lived much in Paris, frequented the Goncourt Grenier, been advised by Maupassant not to attempt to write even that seemed to Archer a dazzling honor, and had often talked with Merimee in his mother's house. He had obviously always been desperately poor and anxious, having a mother and an unmarried sister to provide for, and it was apparent that his literary ambitions had failed. His situation, in fact, seemed, materially speaking, no more brilliant than Ned Winsett's, but he had lived in a world in which, as he said, no one who loved ideas need hunger mentally. As it was precisely of that love that poor Winsett was starving to death, Archer looked with a sort of vicarious envy at this eager, impecunious young man who had fared so richly in his poverty. "You see, monsieur, it's worth everything, isn't it, to keep one's intellectual liberty, not to enslave one's powers of appreciation, one's critical independence? It was because of that I abandoned journalism, and took to so much duller work, tutoring and private secretaryship. There is a good deal of drudgery, of course, but one preserves one's moral freedom, what we call in French one's quant de soi. And when one hears good talk, one can join in it without compromising any opinions but one's own, or one can listen and answer it inwardly. Ah, good conversation, there's nothing like it, is there? The air of ideas is the only air worth breathing. and so I have never regretted giving up either diplomacy or journalism, two different forms of the same self-abdication. He fixed his vivid eyes on Archer as he lit another cigarette. Ois vows, monsieur, to be able to look life in the face. That's worth living in a garret for, isn't it? But, after all, one must earn enough to pay for the garret, and I confess that to grow old as a private tutor or a anything is almost as chilling to the imagination as a second secretaryship at Bucharest. Sometimes I feel I must make a plunge. An immense plunge. Do you suppose, for instance, there would be any opening for me in America in New York? Archer looked at him with startled eyes. New York, for a young man who had frequented the Goncourts and Flaubert, and who thought the life of ideas the only one worth living. He continued to stare at M. Riviere perplexedly, wondering how to tell him that his very superiorities and advantages would be the surest hindrance to success. New York, New York, but must it be especially New York? He stammered, utterly unable to imagine what lucrative opening his native city could offer to a young man to whom good conversation appeared to be the only necessity. A sudden flush rose under M. Riviere's sallow skin. I thought it your metropolis. Is not the intellectual life more active there? He rejoined. Then, as if fearing to give his hearer the impression of having asked a favor, he went on hastily. He throws out random suggestions more to oneself than to others. In reality, I see no immediate prospect, and rising from his seat he added, without a trace of constraint. Mrs. Carfrey will think that I ought to be taking you upstairs. During the homeward drive, Archer pondered deeply on this episode. His hour with M. Riviere had put new air into his lungs, and his first impulse had been to invite him to dine the next day, but he was beginning to understand why married men did not always immediately yield to their first impulses. That young tutor is an interesting fellow. We had some awfully good talk after dinner about books and things, he threw out tentatively in the hansom. May roused herself from one of the dreamy silences into which he had read so many meanings before 6 months of marriage had given him the key to them. The little Frenchman? Wasn't he dreadfully common? She questioned coldly, and he guessed that she nursed a secret disappointment at having been invited out in London to meet a clergyman and a French tutor. The disappointment was not occasioned by the sentiment ordinarily defined as snobbishness, but by old New York's sense of what was due to it when it risked its dignity in foreign lands. If May's parents had entertained the Carfreys in Fifth Avenue, they would have offered them something more substantial than a parson and a schoolmaster. But Archer was on edge, and took her up. Common, common where? He queried, and she returned with unusual readiness. Hi, I should say anywhere but in his schoolroom. Those people are always awkward in society. But then, she added disarmingly, I suppose I shouldn't have known if he was clever. Archer disliked her use of the word clever almost as much as her use of the word almond, but he was beginning to fear his tendency to dwell on the things he disliked in her. After all, her point of view had always been the same. It was that of all the people he had grown up among, and he had always regarded it as necessary but negligible. Until a few months ago he had never known a nice woman who looked at life differently, and if a man married it must necessarily be among the nice. Ah, then I won't ask him to dine, he concluded with a laugh, and May echoed, bewildered. Oodness, asked the Carfrey's tutor. Well, not on the same day with the Carfreys, if you prefer I shouldn't. But I did rather want another talk with him. He's looking for a job in New York. Her surprise increased with her indifference. He almost fancied that she suspected him of being tainted with orinness. A job in New York? What sort of a job? People don't have French tutors. What does he want to do? Chiefly to enjoy good conversation, I understand, her husband retorted perversely, and she broke into an appreciative laugh. H. Newland, how funny! Isn't that French? On the whole, he was glad to have the matter settled for him by her refusing to take seriously his wish to invite M. Riviere. Another after-dinner talk would have made it difficult to avoid the question of New York, and the more Archer considered it, the less he was able to fit M. Riviere into any conceivable picture of New York as he knew it. He perceived with a flash of chilling insight that in future many problems would be thus negatively solved for him. But as he paid the hansom, and followed his wife's long train into the house, he took refuge in the comforting platitude that the first 6 months were always the most difficult in marriage. "Stir that, I suppose we shall have pretty nearly finished rubbing off each other's angles," he reflected. But the worst of it was that May's pressure was already bearing on the very angles whose sharpness he most wanted to keep. XXI. The small bright lawn stretched away smoothly to the big bright sea. The turf was hemmed with an edge of scarlet geranium and callas, and cast iron vases painted in chocolate color, standing at intervals along the winding path that led to the sea, looped their garlands of petunia and ivy geranium above the neatly raked gravel. Halfway between the edge of the cliff and the square wooden house, which was also chocolate colored, but with the tin roof of the veranda striped in yellow and brown to represent an awning, two large targets had been placed against a background of shrubbery. On the other side of the lawn, facing the targets, was pitched a real tent, with benches and garden seats about it. A number of ladies in summer dresses, and gentlemen in gray frock coats, and tall hats stood on the lawn or sat upon the benches. And every now and then a slender girl in starched muslin would step from the tent, bow in hand, and speed her shaft at one of the targets, while the spectators interrupted their talk to watch the result. Newland Archer, standing on the veranda of the house, looked curiously down upon the scene. On each side of the shiny painted steps was a large blue china flower pot on a bright yellow china stand. A spiky green plant filled each pot, and below the veranda ran a wide border of blue hydrangeas etched with more red geraniums. Behind him, the French windows of the drawing rooms through which he had passed gave glimpses, between swaying lace curtains, of glassy parquet floors islanded with chintz puffs, dwarf armchairs, and velvet tables covered with trifles in silver. The Newport Archery Club always held its August meeting at the Beauforts. The sport, which had hitherto known no rival but croquet, was beginning to be discarded in favor of lawn tennis, but the latter game was still considered too rough and inelegant for social occasions, and as an opportunity to show off pretty dresses and graceful attitudes, the bow and arrow held their own. Archer looked down with wonder at the familiar spectacle. It surprised him that life should be going on in the old way, when his own reactions to it had so completely changed. It was Newport that at first brought home to him the extent of the change. In New York, during the previous winter, after he and May had settled down in the new greenish-yellow house with the bow window and the Pompeian vestibule, he had dropped back with relief into the old routine of the office, and the renewal of this daily activity had served as a link with his former self. Then there had been the pleasurable excitement of choosing a showy gray stepper for May's brougham. The Wellands had given the carriage, and the abiding occupation and interest of arranging his new library, which, in spite of family doubts and disapprovals, had been carried out as he had dreamed, with a dark embossed paper, Eastlick bookcases and insier armchairs and tables. At the Century he had found Winsett again, and at the Knickerbocker the fashionable young men of his own set, and what with the hours dedicated to the law, and those given to dining out or entertaining friends at home, with an occasional evening at the opera or the play, the life he was living had still seemed a fairly real and inevitable sort of business. But Newport represented the escape from duty into an atmosphere of unmitigated holiday-making. Archer had tried to persuade May, To spend the summer on a remote island off the coast of Maine, called, appropriately enough, Mount Desert, where a few hardy Bostonians and Philadelphians were camping in Ative cottages, and whence came reports of enchanting scenery and a wild, almost trapper-like existence amid woods and waters. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.